Now, ActionAid South Africa, a global movement of people working together to further human rights and defeat poverty, has released a social audit baseline report focusing on mining in South Africa. The social audit baseline report was conducted in 10 mining affected communities across the country. The report only includes the outcomes of the survey from 8 communities in Mpumalanga, Gauteng, Northwest, Limpopo, the Northern Cape, the Free State, and KwaZulu-Natal. The findings from the report has broadly confirmed that mining affecting communities are unfairly affected by mining, not only because of their closeness to the mines, but also because of the political, economic, and social difficulties they face in holding corporations and government to account. Now, of course, this report is coming out and coinciding with the mining summit that has been held in the country. We know that it was opened by Minerals Minister Gwede Mantashe, and of course, in the first time in the history of South Africa, a president actually addressed the conference. So there's obviously a lot of attention on mining in the way in which people see growing the economy. But we also need to, of course, look at what the effects of that mining is and whether the benefits go to the people that really need it. And for that purpose, I'm going to be focusing on the results of the survey conducted by ActionAid. And I'm joined in the studio by Christopher Rutledge, who is the Natural Resources Manager at ActionAid. Christopher, good evening. Welcome to the program.
Good evening. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Now, Christopher, the report looks bleak, especially for mining communities. I mean, if you look at some of the issues that have come out of your summary, I'll quote a few and we can speak to it. It says, among the key findings and statistics of the baseline survey are that 64% of the respondents surveyed were women and 30% were men. 62 indicated that they were single, 26 married, 64% education up to secondary level, and 13 indicated at tertiary level or higher. And then 44 respondents indicated that their main source of income was from social grants in the Pola area in Mpumalanga and the Somkhele area in KwaZulu-Natal. And that indicated a 59% and 53% reliance on social grants, respectively. Then it also says 24% indicated that they survive on petty trading and self-employment. And only 30% indicated some type of formal employment. And 73% of the respondents indicated that no individuals in their households were either currently employed or previously employed by the mines. And then 27% who indicated that someone in their household was appointed or rather employed at a mine. 41% indicated that they were casual or manual jobs. Now, I mean, that doesn't paint a picture that mining actually helps South African communities. Mining has long been, over hundreds of years, the mainstay of our economy. It's been an extractive process with very little beneficiation for communities. Give us some of the most startling information that came out of your report about how communities that live around mines are actually affected by them.
Yeah, thanks, Karima. I think you touched on a couple of them there. I think kind of floating through that stats that you read was the reality that 70% of communities are unemployed in mining-affected communities. 30%.
So where do those mining companies get their workers from? Do they source them from other places? Is that the issue of migrancy that is brought in? So they don't actually employ people from the communities where the mines are based?
Yeah, that's a big concern. In fact, this came throughout all the surveys, is that there is a growing sentiment within communities around the influx of people from outside and the fact that they're not seeing any advancement. And so the the seeds of a xenophobic response
is
being laid in all of these communities, because every single community picked on this point that people are coming from outside to take jobs and we're sitting here unemployed. So that's a huge concern. And certainly one of the things that all the mines promise is we'll come here and we'll bring you jobs like they're doing in Kolobeni.
Yeah.
So the reality is that they don't.
Yes.
They employ a couple of people, like the report said. Of those 23% who claim that either they or their family member had been employed by the mine, 40% of those says it's menial jobs, casual contract, and doesn't last for very long. So that's not an indication of a developmental type of situation.
Yeah.
It's more an exploitative one. And the fact that communities are sitting there feeling the toxic response. So there's this, one of the major things that came out is that all the communities are saying that they are suffering health deficits,
consequences,
because of the environment, because of the general unsafe feeling that they have. So people feel unsafe. They feel like they're living in a violent situation with blasts occurring all the time, with violence growing in the community, and that they kind of point to outsiders coming in. And so people feeling unsafe, they're feeling sick, they're feeling left behind, they're feeling forgotten. And that's a keg, it's a time bomb.
Yes.
And if we don't deal with it, then we're going to find that Marikanas are going to start emerging all over the place. And I think I want to say that we are very disappointed in the way that government has responded to our report. In fact, they haven't responded.
Mm.
And they're kind of putting the head in the sand and saying, look, all is rosy. And we understand that mining is a central player, has been and can be. And we understand that the government wants to attract investment, but we've got to look at the thing holistically. We can't just kind of head down a path and say, never mind the last 25 years that has produced all this inequality. Let's continue down this path because that's all we know. Mm. And that is not healthy, and we think that's deeply problematic.
Now, of course, there's this big debate also around whether mining is a sunset or sunrise industry. We were discussing this last night, and one of the analysts, Peter Major, was saying it is a sunset industry in terms of certain minerals, like, for example, gold and so on. And we find in South Africa we have to go deeper and longer to actually extract these minerals, which means that issues around safety is a big thing. We spoke to a safety expert, and she says one of the big issues is that we're not keeping up with technology. Mm-hmm. We're not training the safety officers properly. We're not designing clothing for them that is comfortable to wear in particular conditions when they have to go in. So there's a lot that's wrong with mining.
Mm-hmm.
Now, government often has these summits with all the kind of constituencies, and then there's all these pledges that are made. But there's no one that actually sits there and watch and implement and watch compliance in issues of safety, in issues of, just getting people a better deal, where mining isn't seen as labor being chattel, essentially.
Yeah. So I think that's another area that we would like to start talking to government about, because we're not quite sure what the Minister Mantashe is, whether he is a economics minister trying to invite investment, whether he's the regulator or whether he's a politician.
Yeah.
So there's this conflation, all these things in one, and that's a recipe again for creating conflict. So if the DMR is going to be the regulator, then they need to do their job.
Yes.
They should not be focusing on attracting investment. Those things should be separated out.
Yes.
So when we speak to investors, we must say, come and invest. These are the things that we can do for you. But when we regulate you, we're not going to be held to ransom by the fact that you're an investor.
Yeah.
Because that's what happens. So the DMR cannot hold business to account because they're begging them for business that they're in Durba. So how do you go beg the one day and hold them to account the next day?
This is exactly what Peter Major was arguing. He was, and I mean, he's a pro-mining company, and he was essentially saying that, you know, the more regulations there are, the more rules there are, people are just going to say, well, let me take my money elsewhere. Let's go to Turkey. Let's go to Mexico. Let's go to wherever because, you know, there's just too many rules to kind of comply with. And I think you're onto something about the fact that the DMR shouldn't be involved in investing, getting investors. The economics ministry should be doing that. They should be looking after the sector and looking after, of course, all the safety and the issues of all the different parties. Now, Mr. Mantashe has, I've interviewed him. He's gone through a consultation process or what he calls a consultation process. And we often see that it's quite choreographed arrangements where people that have already been spoken to before come together and you can kind of tick a box and so on. Kolobeni is an example of that. It's a community that has resisted for 15 years that their land be used for mining because they believe they can use the land differently. There's also our commitment, of course, to COP around emissions and stuff like that. Where does the fault lie, Christopher? Does it lie with our conceptualization of this industry and the consequences thereof and who's responsible? Or is it just a question of let's get investment because we haven't got jobs, we haven't got an economy that's growing and we need to get it going?
Yeah, I think it's definitely a paradigm that needs to shift. Because there's no doubt that there's wealth being created by mining, all right? So that's another kind of argument that we won't even go into today because if one puts in a element of natural capital depletion, if one puts that on your balance sheet, then you realize that our net, the net win that we get is zero. We're not getting enough for our money for the minerals that we're giving up. But more than that, there is wealth being created. Half of the wealth is being flighted out of the country illegally or through base profit and profit erosion. The other half is 30% of that goes to the shareholders. Government is getting about 22% in taxes and royalties. The workers are getting a portion. And then the communities who are the ones who are directly affected, who are carrying the cost of this exploitation, they are supposed to get 0.9%, but our research is showing that of that 0.9% that they're supposed to get, 80% of them are not filtering down. So it means that the trickle-down economy that this whole thing is built on is not working. So for us to say that we just want to invite investment because that's going to create jobs, it's not true. It's not creating jobs. It is not producing a social benefit. And the money is being stopped at the top, and it's deepening the inequality, which we know South Africa is being as one of the most unequal countries in the world. So there's a logic there that just doesn't compute. Who are they inviting investment for? Is it for an elite few and for the connected individuals? Or is it that we want to build a developmental society? If that is the case, then we really need to look at how we do this. One of the things that I am concerned about with Peter Major's argument, for example, is the fact that he's asking us to engage in a battle to the bottom, a rush to the bottom. Who's going to get to the bottom first? Who's going to stop asking for taxes? Who's not going to regulate? Let's give business a free arm and let them just do what they want. That is unrealistic. It's not the way the world needs to move. And Peter Major should not be advocating that kind of lawless approach to it, because the reality is that mining is a violent industry. We see this across Africa, where some countries are not even getting any tax benefit because they're trying to attract investment. So they say, we'll give you a tax holiday for 10 years. The ninth year, the company closes down and moves on. Who's winning then?
Absolutely. Christopher, we're running out of time. A final question. Engagement with Gwedem and Tasha has been very difficult. The Kolobeni community, for example, often feels that he comes uninvited. When he does come, he comes with the police, he comes with a set of people. Have you tried engaging with the policymakers to try and begin to shift their mindset to this? Because one of the things that concerned me greatly also is the role of the trade unions. I've spoken to all of the trade unions, and they have this idea that the only thing that matters to them are the jobs of their members. But we've seen them complicit in state capture, both in Bosasa as well as the Guptas. And that goes for all the unions. We've seen also killings in unions like AMCO, for example, when people ask difficult questions. So the sins of incumbency hasn't just visited the African National Congress and the government. It's also actually visited trade unions and the elite in trade unions.
Yeah.
How are you going to go about engaging these key stakeholders to begin to shift their mindset and get them to understand that this is an unsustainable way to go forward?
No, you're absolutely correct. I mean, this narrow focus on jobs in the trade unions is a bit toxic for our society because it doesn't help find broader solutions. So I agree with you on that. We have consistently been reaching out to unions, and the only unions that have been open to talking and working with communities have been NUMSA, who are very peripheral in the sector, even though they're growing. And AMCU has worked with us around issues like the People's Mining Charter. And SAFTU has indicated that they are interested. And unfortunately, the National Union of Mine Workers have been completely silent. In fact, we've tracked their submissions to Parliament as we engaged around the MPRDA. And their submissions have been not community-friendly, let's put it like that. So it's very parochial, it's very inward-looking, and it's kind of, let's protect
our jobs. And
it's actually
quite interesting because historically that's not what our unions have done.
Yeah.
Our unions have understood that the struggles in communities are similar to the struggles on the factory floor, similar to the struggles in the student movement. And there was often a kind of coming together and a coherent approach being done. Do you think that just the fact that we have such high rates of unemployment is partly the reason why people have such an inward looking approach? I mean, you have unions saying, "Let's not do power producers and stick to coal." It's like someone walking around with a bag dragging ice when a fridge has already been invented.
So absolutely. So that's why we say there needs to be a paradigm shift in the way that we approach mining. We cannot be going with a 19th century outlook in the 21st century. The world has changed, and South Africa has got particular problems of deep inequality and driving poverty. So we need to find solutions that are going to be more inclusive, not less inclusive. So this is the difficulty. And this thing emerges when we have conversations around artisanal miners, Zama Zamas, for example. We've been trying to talk to the DMR for the longest time about re-looking at rethinking the way that we look at Zama Zamas, because these people are poor people, people living in poverty who just want to eke out a living. If we can regulate it, then more people, and in fact, in March, we bring out another research survey that we've done with Zama Zama miners, which shows that the livelihood options that this creates is a significant boost to the economies around there. So we have to change our paradigm. We have to look out. And government has to talk, you know, because I was just speaking to the South African Human Rights Commission yesterday, and they're saying that they can't get hold of government. They phone Mr. Mantashe and he doesn't answer.
Absolutely. And I think this is one of the big challenges. We've got to hold government to account, but we've also got to commit government to a transparent process and an engagement process, because there are other ways of doing things. We're not saying don't attract investment, but be saying don't do it at the cost of communities that suffer the consequences. Christopher Rutledge, thank you so very much for joining us.